Time is 1:40 and the day is 11 February 1982. The place is the Judiciary Hearing Room, 124, the Capitol in Juneau. I'd like the record to reflect that the members present for this meeting today are Representative Coxon, Representative Hayes, Representative Liska, and myself, and visiting is Representative Locker. Representative Barnes will join in a little bit, and Representative Malone is on a long-distance call at the moment, and hopefully he too will join us in a little bit. The length of the list for the celebrities present is too long. Probably we'd spend most of the afternoon introducing everybody, so we'll bypass that for the moment. There is a sign-up sheet at the door, and those of you that are going to testify in addition to the ones that we have on the published agenda, I'd appreciate it if you intended to testify at the end of the meeting or would like to today that you'd sign that so I could have that in a timely fashion. If there are none, I think we'll begin today by taking discussion from the Attorney General, Mr. Norm Gorsuch. The subject that he wishes to give a brief overview on is Clary versus Byrne. It's a highly controversial settlement. Hopefully his testimony and the rest of them today will help answer the myriad of questions that this committee and half of the state of Alaska has with regard to just what this case is going to do to every Alaskan. Mr. Gorsuch, if you Representative Fox.
Let me just ask a preliminary question. Apparently we don't have a bill before us, so this is sort of a background
that's
session.
Right. It's in every way that we've explained it to you. It's a work session hearing to try to gather information. As you know, what happens here today very probably will affect Executive Order 54, which is the governor's order requesting that we establish the Department of Corrections. We also have a House concurrent resolution coming through to object to that executive order. We also have a House bill, as I explained to you, in the works to create a Department of Correction, too. Representative Clarkson.
The other question is, are we planning on finishing with the subject today? We've got a pretty long list, and it's a very complicated issue. Are you planning just one day for this?
As you can see by the pile of stuff, there's no way that we could even read it, much less hear it. This is the first of what probably will be a long list of people, and there will be hearing, more hearing in a more formal manner at some time in the future, probably. But right now, I don't know that I know enough about Clary to do much more than gather these piles of documents that we've gathered. And quite frankly, right up till 1:30 today, I was still talking to the Bureau of Federal Prisons in Burlingame, who somewhat confused about some of the issues that were settled last Friday, and I think with cause. Mr. Gorsuch, if you'd state your name so that the sound system could pick it up for the record and then proceed in a manner such as it will, we'd appreciate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Norman Gorsuch, and I'm the Attorney General. Thank you for the opportunity to appear today to brief the committee on this rather significant case, which does have potentially far-reaching effects on the administration and management and costs associated with our correctional system. The way I would propose to proceed, Mr. Chairman, is that I was planning to give a sort of a very brief and somewhat broadly brush-stroked overview of the case, and I have with me here today Mr. Mike Stark, who is the Assistant Attorney General who has been handling this case. And what we would like to do during the course of these proceedings is provide you with a sort of an overall historical explanation of this matter. And we think that during the course of that, and we'll try to keep it as brief as possible, many questions and concerns may be answered in terms of the issues and what the current status of the matter is, and would be a good basis, I think, for your subsequent deliberations and work on the corrections problems. Basically, this particular case is not untypical. There are many such lawsuits filed regularly across the country, and this case involves a class action that was filed on behalf of prisoners in 7 of the state's correctional institutions, and also affecting those prisoners outside of the state that are currently housed by the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And the case was, the complaint was filed in August of 1981, and the state litigated the matter for approximately 10 months. During that time, an attempt on the part of the plaintiffs to broaden the applicability of the results of this case to all institutions in the state of Alaska and to the Bush contract jails was successfully opposed by the state, so that the effects of this particular lawsuit apply to the 7 institutions originally filed against by the plaintiffs. Then after approximately 10 months, the judge ordered the parties to sit down and commence discussing methods of resolving the issues outstanding between the parties. The class action generally is related to, in a broad sense, the treatment accorded prisoners in the correctional institutions with respect to medical care, health care, recreational opportunities, visitation rights, procedural rights in disciplinary proceedings, and so forth, generally running the full ambit of the conditions respecting the confinement of prisoners in the system. The in November of 1982, the state, under the previous administration, executed a partial settlement stipulation, and that settled what, in the parlance of this case, has come to be known, the non-big ticket items. That is, those issues which did not require an excessively large expenditure of public funds to implement, and those essentially involved the addition of monitors in the facilities, which I understand the cost there was pegged to be at about $300,000 additional expense per annum. The so-called big ticket items, that is, those items that would require a substantial additional expenditure of state funds to implement, such as those relating to recreation, the medical care, dental care, and the monitoring and implementation of increased visitation rights and so forth. These so-called big ticket items were held out of the settlement, and those items are still pending, and the state is scheduled to join issue with the plaintiffs in a contested trial in June of 1983. There are some, there's another issue with respect to those prisoners housed outside, the Federal Bureau of Prisoners, and with respect to those prisoners, there was an additional settlement just last week, which requires that those prisoners be brought home within 5 years, contingent upon the construction of a maximum security facility in the state of Alaska. Because these prisoners in the federal prisons are housed in facilities that more closely resemble maximum security facilities. So where we are now is that we are, the Department of Law is preparing to gear up and contest these issues in June. We think that because of the nature of the issues and the potential revenue or the potential expenditure requirements, that it's valuable and useful that the legislature acquaint itself with the possible outcome of this case and the possible impacts of the case, so that you will be familiar with the potential requirements that may be placed upon the state as a result of what may happen in the trial, or should the matter be resolved short of trial, what potential impacts might be. I would like to say that at the current time there are historically in this country at the moment many prison systems that are being operated by special masters appointed by the courts of the country, because of the feeling on the part of the courts that
existing treatment of prisoners is not in compliance with the federal or state constitutions as interpreted by the respective state Supreme Courts and the United States Supreme Court. And as a result of that, certainly one possible outcome of unfair litigation might be the appointment of a special master, and in effect, a special master that would sit in the corrections office and in effect,
make many, many day-to-day decisions with respect to the treatment of prisoners. So we think it's very important for the legislature to take a serious look at this case, the legal issues surrounding this case, and weigh those carefully against the costs and the possible outcomes. And I have nothing further to add, Mr. Chairman, and of course, would be pleased to answer any questions if I can.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Garcia. Representative Clarkson?
I have two questions. First of all, I think a short one. Is your testimony that the settlement entered into and approved by Judge Cerdaley on January 21st will cost approximately $300,000 to implement? That's the one you're referring to?
That is the one that I am given to understand may be the cost, but that is not, I'm not speaking here specifically to that. That's what was represented to me by...
Okay, I'm not trying to pin you down, but just the general ballpark, that's what we're talking about. When you're talking about the little ticket items, you're talking about the things in the January 23rd.
That's correct. That's what I am given to understand. Mr. Endell can probably enlighten you in much more specific detail.
I have a broader question, which I think is important to get to, and it's a legal question. The question is, and it doesn't, let's not pin ourselves just this lawsuit, but let's assume that the state is sued in any given case, and either through court or after trial or settlement, that there are requirements of the administration, the defendant in the case. Those requirements take money, and let's assume that the settlement or the court order is not contingent, as the Federal Bureau of Prisons party is here. Mm-hmm. Say they simply order the state to do something. Mm-hmm. Let's say that the money is not available for that.
And the administration makes all best efforts to obtain that money from the legislature and does not. The legal question is who, if anyone, is subject to contempt of court or any other remedy for failing to comply with the order of the court. It's always been a real puzzle for me what happens if the state loses a lawsuit but the legislature refuses to provide the money available to implement the order.
I would suspect that probably the administration officials and of the respective departments are possibly subject to contempt, and that could be very uncomfortable for them. I think that in the final analysis there is a broader issue which has never been fully explored, and we have always very gingerly skirted the issue, and that is what happens if, in fact, monies are not appropriated to implement court-ordered programs. And then, do we not have a situation, and we have not come down with any analysis of it in detail, but do we not have a situation in which the courts may mandamus Treasury to open up and pay those judgment costs? That is a possible issue. I think there may be a lot of reasons why courts would pursue that course somewhat gingerly, but nevertheless, if in fact there is no other remedy available to them, it could prove to be an interesting constitutional issue.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask you a question. You said these other states are operated by, or have systems operating with special masters. Which, do you happen to recall, do you know any, which of those states might be?
I don't have them off the top of my head.
Free to come to mind, but I mean, okay, well, when you get up, I can ask you if you know.
I don't want to represent that because I'm not certain, but I do know that there are states that are being operated, in effect, by special masters right now.
But if you don't know which ones they are, then you don't know why they're operating as special masters. Is it simply because of an overcrowding situation, or is it because they failed to negotiate conditions, or?
My understanding is that in these particular cases, that they generally are rooted in, the foundation tends to be overcrowding, which in turn is related to insufficient facilities, and then built upon that, there are usually
accompany
in these situations are usually accompanied by questions as to the adequacy of medical care, dental care, access to attorneys for appeal purposes, disciplinary proceeding procedures. There's generally a gamut of particular treatment issues that arise in the context of this kind of situation. If it's, and overcrowding is certainly an issue, because that can produce many of the conditions that raise the other issues.
I want one or a couple more questions while I've got you here. Are you familiar with this Mosley case that Judge Carlson is about to terminate or is working with right now?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not personally familiar with that case. I believe Mr. Stark is familiar with that case and could probably enlighten the committee on that.
And before I forget it, I'd like the record to show that Representative Malone and Representative Barnes arrived some time ago, and we were in the midst of testimony, and I apologize for not mentioning it at the time. To continue, I listened to the tapes. I just got the tapes a few hours ago of Judge Cerdaley's hearing last Friday, and unless I misunderstood or heard there, that whatever happens in the Carlson, or in the in this Mosley case, is also going to become part of this class action suit. So we actually have two judges dealing with the Clary case right now. Is that not correct?
I think what we have are basically two different pieces of litigation, and the Division of Corrections, and hence the state, is responding to two different judges discussing two different sets of issues and affecting different facilities. But basically, we're running back and forth between two different judges at the moment, because they're separate cases.
Have you seen, or are you familiar with this partial settlement compliance manual that we just received this morning for the implementation of this one?
I am not, Mr. Chairman. I just saw it this morning when it was pointed out to me, so I can't comment on any of the contents.
I don't have any further questions. Have you had members of the committee, the Attorney General, Representative?
Let me just ask, some questions may arise after some of the other testimony that raised policy questions. I guess, are you planning on sticking around for this, or are you planning on leaving?
I have some other appointments, but I certainly can be summoned back then.
Or if we are going to cover it on another day, maybe we can kind of plan on having you back. I think there'll be more questions of you on the policy level.
Yeah, it was the committee's intention to get as many department heads as we could here to answer as many overall questions as we could, and that's why Mr. Stark is here to get more detail. And if we develop stuff that we're going to have, well, obviously in future hearings, I'm sure you'll be more than happy to attend.
I certainly will, Mr. Chairman.
Are there further questions? Representative Liska.
Yes, Mr. Gorsuch, are we the only state that is unique in this particular problem that you're aware of?
Unique in terms of the
issues
in this case, and these kinds of cases are frequently filed across the country. It's been a trend in the law for the last 10 or 15 years, perhaps. And I think there's something like 29 states that have restrictions placed on them in one form or another by the court orders with respect to treatment of prisoners and correctional policy.
Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But we would maybe be unique in terms of incarcerating people outside the state. Is that a unique feature of Alaska?
I can't answer that, Representative Hayes. I don't know for sure. I think there may be, depending upon the quality of facilities in different states as compared to federal facilities, there may be cross incarceration arrangements in other states as well.
I think that we may be unique in the number that we have there. As of this morning, we have 191 people, according to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, in the system. Representative Liska.
Maybe one more question here. We probably will give our other witnesses a chance maybe to think about this before they get up here to testify. I am hearing comments, at least two from the Clary case, that has brought it about that Some of the prisoners in the outside federal prison systems are afraid of their lives. They want to get out, they want to come back to Alaska. What is your opinion? Would you have an opinion on this, or have you heard anything like this, or do they have justification to make a statement like this? Are their lives in danger in these federal prison systems where we have quite a few of them out there now?
I really can't answer that, and I wouldn't want to mislead the committee. I think perhaps some of the other witnesses might be able to give you a very accurate answer on that.
If there are no further questions of the Attorney General, we could excuse him at this time and proceed on to the next witness. And I certainly thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come down here and give us the overview you did. And I'm almost positive that we'll develop other things and we'd like to chat with you later.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it.
And the next witness that we'd like to chat with is Dr. Robert Smith. He's Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. And if he's not here, I haven't seen him come in. And I haven't seen the next one is Evil Naughty, and I haven't seen Evil either come in. And the next one down is Michael Stark, the Assistant Attorney General. And if you'll step to the chair at the end. As I understand it, Mr. Stark has been the Assistant Attorney General and has handled this entire case almost since its inception. Perhaps some of those finer questions that we have, he can answer because of his close and lengthy involvement. Mr. Stark, if you'll state your name for the record and then proceed in the manner such as you will, we appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Stark. I am employed with the Department of Law as an Assistant Attorney General, and I am counsel for the Division of Corrections. I've been in that position for almost 3 years now. What I will do is briefly touch upon some of the areas Attorney General Gorsuch also mentioned and perhaps get into some more detail as to areas he might have just briefly skipped over him, and give you a sort of a historical perspective of how this case originated, the issues that were raised in the complaint, what's happened over the last approximate year and a half since the case was filed, and where we are at the present time. And I hope to answer some of the questions that I anticipate you'll be asking during my presentation, and certainly any that I don't, I'd welcome questions when I'm finished. Perhaps I could even begin briefly with responding to the last question by Representative Lister. I visited two of the federal prison last summer conducting depositions in this case. Leavenworth facility
in Kansas and the Lompoc facility in Southern California, both institutions of which hold in excess of 1,100 prisoners. And spoke with several Alaskan prisoners there, as well as the staffs in those facilities, the warden, the executive assistants of the warden. And I think that there is no question that there is the violence that occurs in federal institutions and frankly in large facilities generally is much higher than we see in our own in-state institutions, and that therefore the risk of harm to our prisoners there is certainly greater than it is here. I think that some of the concerns by Alaskan prisoners in those institutions are legitimate in terms of their concern for their personal safety. I also suspect that it's somewhat exaggerated in some circumstances, but an Alaska prisoner was killed a little over a year ago down in the Lompoc facility, and in fact inmates of those facilities are killed and injured on a regular basis. I don't have any per capita figures for you, but you know, I don't believe an inmate has been killed in an Alaskan institution that I can recall that that's ever happened. Certainly injuries occur from time to time, but not anywhere near the rate that they occur in the federal institutions. Cleary et al. Versus Byrne et al. Is a lawsuit that has been threatened to be filed since December of 1977. Attorneys in the private bar, members of the American Civil Liberties Union, the Public Defender Agency, Alaska Legal Services, at one time or another have been threatening to file this kind of lawsuit. And it wasn't until August of 1981 that it finally occurred. As the Attorney General indicated, it specifically involves seven of the state prisons. plus our prisoners in the federal prison system. If I can very briefly indicate to you the issues, the general issues that were raised in the complaint, so you'll have a little more in-depth understanding of the kinds of things that the state has been accused of violating in terms of what the prisoners have been asking the court for. As a preliminary, it was alleged that the United States Constitution, the state constitution, state statutes, and state regulations have all been violated in terms of the treatment prisoners have been receiving. As far as the in-state facilities were concerned, very quickly, the numerous issues that were raised in the complaint deal with overcrowding, the physical plans of the institutions, including plumbing, heat, ventilation, lighting, understaffing, and inadequate classification of prisoners in terms of increasing the risk of harm to prisoners, idleness of prisoners, inadequate mental and physical health care, lack of access to visiting and to telephones, lack of adequate access to the courts. This includes confidential space to meet with attorneys, adequate law libraries, inadequate exercise, challenged food services and in terms of nutrition, the temperature of meals, things of that sort. They challenged the mail regulations in terms of First Amendment rights being violated, reading the mail improperly, those kinds of things. They challenged the disciplinary and segregation procedures as being unconstitutional. They have alleged that training is insufficient for correctional officers and there's a lack of screening in the hiring process so that people who are dealing with prisoners on a regular basis who shouldn't be are in those jobs. And finally, they challenged the lack of sufficient rehabilitative programs. In the federal part of the lawsuit that dealing with our prisoners in the federal system, the issues that were raised there are less in number, but I'll briefly summarize those for you if I could. They challenged basically the lack of equal access to the parole board, the Alaska parole board from our state prisoners out in the federal system, the lack of equal access to any type of counselors in the institution who are familiar with Alaska law, parole requirements, that kind of thing, so that they can have advice on how to prepare parole plans or apply for furloughs. They challenge access to the courts, again, access to their attorneys, to a sufficient amount of Alaskan law materials so that they can pursue legal remedies in courts here. They have alleged that their due process rights under the Constitution have been violated as a result of arbitrary loss of good time and the fact that their disciplinary hearings out in the federal system are not tape recorded, which is required in state. They have challenged that their right to rehabilitation has been infringed in terms of the risk of violence that they are experiencing and also the fact that they're isolated away from their families and friends. And finally, they have challenged that, well, they've alleged that there's inadequate classification such that they are placed in facilities which are more restrictive than are necessary for their safekeeping. From August of 1981 until May of 82, as the Attorney General indicated, a fairly large amount of resources were expended by both sides in this lawsuit on such things as discovery, which is, you know, the compiling of information, documents and records to basically see if there is any validity to the allegations that were made in the complaint, and in terms of contesting different motions. A major one was, as the Attorney General indicated, an attempt by plaintiffs to enlarge the lawsuit, and we did successfully oppose that. And in June of 1982, after almost 10 months of litigation going on, Judge Douglas Erdaly, who's a Superior Court judge in Anchorage and who is presiding over this case, ordered the parties to sit down and to begin negotiations and serious discussions on the issues raised in the case and to attempt to resolve them short of trial if at all possible. It became clear during the discovery process and during the early settlement discussions that the state was at a disadvantage in some areas because, in fact, the state was not in compliance with state laws. Some examples would be requirements by Division of Corrections' own regulations of providing 7 hours of exercise or recreation a week for each prisoner. The applicable building and fire life safety codes, and I know that Deputy Fire Marshal Brunton is here, he may speak to that. But it became clear in getting below the surface that, in fact, the state was not complying with all of the legal requirements, and certainly not the requirements that federal case law and the United States Supreme Court decisions seem to require, in, for instance, in the area of disciplinary and segregation procedures in terms of due process rights of inmates. Several months were spent, beginning in June, all the way and probably until October of 82, literally hundreds of hours, both research and sitting down with plaintiff's counsel. The two facets of the lawsuit were separated so that I was dealing with different attorneys on the federal part of the lawsuit and the in-state part. Oftentimes, Judge Cerdillo would participate in these settlement discussions. Mr. Hatrack, the former director of corrections, participated frequently. And in fact, one session, Commissioner Byrne, Deputy Commissioner Corjona, Attorney General Condon participated along with the judge and counsel for both sides. And it became clear that a decision had to be made whether to litigate and what issues to litigate, or whether to attempt to resolve all or parts of the lawsuit short of trial. The considerations that were looked at were many. Obviously, the state had to look at the option of litigating, and if they were to lose, what would happen? Anytime a party to a lawsuit litigates and loses, it results in a court order in which the losing party has very little or no control at all over what goes into the court order. An example of this is the Mosley lawsuit. If I can just divert for a moment talking about that, try to answer some of the prior questions. That was a lawsuit brought in 1976 by the prisoners of the 6th Avenue Pretrial Facility in Anchorage. It was a class action suit related only to that one institution. The state chose at that time, for various reasons, to litigate that case fully and go to trial. It did go to trial in December of 1977, early 1978, and the state lost that trial and have been under a final judgment in that case since February 1979. It's 4 years now. And the state is still dealing with pending motions for contempt for non-compliance with the requirements of that final judgment. The state has been found to be in contempt on more than one occasion. There have been extreme difficulties in attempting to comply with a court order in that case. It was only last year when a management or policy decision within the Division of Corrections to develop a form of compliance monitoring, which in fact the manual you made reference to in the Cleary case is based on. It was based on the decision by the officials at the 6th Avenue Correctional Facility to come up with some kind of compliance manual and appoint somebody full-time to oversee the implementation of the court order. And it was only after that the 6th Avenue Facility has gotten out of trouble, is an excellently run institution, and in fact it's turned out that the correctional officers at that institution are now more familiar with what their responsibilities are, and perhaps Mr. Schmidt, who be here to speak later, and who is the assistant superintendent at that institution and was involved in the formulation of the compliance monitoring at that institution and is also Corrections Central Office compliance monitor on the Cleary case. Perhaps he can answer any questions after the compliance monitoring that's going on. At any rate, besides looking at the possibilities of litigating and what might happen if we lost, we looked at the direction that courts around the country, as well as in the state, have gone in similar lawsuits. And as the Attorney General stated, there are presently 29 states under court order as to their correctional systems. A substantial number of those are right now operating under the disability of a special master running the correction system or some facet of it. I'll talk about that a little more shortly. Looking at what the Alaska Supreme Court has done in the area of prisoner litigation, we looked at the McGinnis versus Stevens case, which came down in 1975, and where our state Supreme Court required that all prisoner disciplinary hearings be tape recorded, something that only a few states have required. The Supreme Court came down with a decision in 1979, which is known as the Locke decision, which required the correction system to give credit for time served to all our prisoners who spend time in any kind of a residential program, halfway house, where there's any counseling involved, anything of that sort. So what we're looking at, that plus the decision in the Mosley case, which was handed down by Judge Singleton, who's now on the Court of Appeals, The indication, as I think many of you probably already recognize, is that the Alaska courts are quite liberal, as if we have to look at a continuum from conservative to liberal. And in looking at what the courts have done elsewhere, and particularly decisions in this past year, the question was put as to what systems are under special masters. Right now, the state of Texas correctional system, which is the largest system in the country, is operating the result of a June 82 decision from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. It's a federal case. Is now functioning under the auspices of a special master who has a complete staff to oversee that correctional system. State of Arkansas recently was placed under a special master. In 1980, state of New Mexico, as a result of the riot they had and litigation that followed, was placed under control of a special master. And my understanding, in that case, the special master went to the governor and demanded $100 million and said he'd be back when that was through. There are clearly some limitations set down by some courts as to the powers of special masters, and other courts make it more wide open. The other option, obviously, of litigating or litigating the whole case is resolving all or part of it short of trial. There's no question that any time you do that, there is some compromise involved, and you don't get everything you like. But what you do get is some direct input into what any court order resulting from that is going to state. We looked at several things in this case, the number of states that are under court order and what happened in those cases. The issues are similar. There's nothing unique, really, in the issues that are raised in our case that have not been raised in other similar lawsuits elsewhere. One thing that impressed us considerably is the fact that when a state falls under a court order, whether it's been litigated, whether or not there's a special master, we find the court or the special master telling the state what to spend its money on, how much to spend, and basically takes away any flexibility retained by the executive branches or legislative branches as to operating the correctional system. This was done in a smaller context in the Mosley case back in 1979. We also looked at the various standards that are in existence as to correctional institutions. The primary emphasis was given to looking at the American Correctional Association standards. For those of you who don't know, the American Correctional Association is probably the preeminent organization in this country, made up of correctional professionals, people who run our prison systems, who run the prisons from all over the country. I have a copy of those available for anybody who'd like to look at them. In addition, I recently discovered a set of standards on federal standards on prison and jails put out by the United States Department of Justice, which they have, in 1980, which they recommend that state and municipal prison systems attempt to come into compliance with. And in addition, we brought in three experts from out of state, from different parts of the country, had them tour our prison system and look at the complaint and look at the analyses that we'd had done by outside consultants in the past, and to give us their best judgment as to where we should go with the lawsuit. And uniformly, they recommended settling the lawsuit. They did not suggest that we simply cave into all requests or demands by the prisoners, but that settlement in this kind of a lawsuit, given the conditions that we had, would give us the most flexibility to deal with the problems that I think everyone acknowledges exist in our correctional system right now. We, of course, also looked at what the prisons were asking for and what the state prison officials, the director of corrections, the commissioner of health and social services, the attorney general, the governor at the time, Governor Hammond, what they were willing to agree to. And both in the context of the legal requirements, what statutes require, what the Constitution requires as interpreted by the courts, and also policy considerations, whether or not to agree to something irrespective of whether it was technically required by the law. But would it, in fact, be advantageous to do that for policy reasons, such as management tools for our administrators in the prison? As you are aware, we did resolve large portions of the suit. The settlements were supported by the former administration, by the former attorney general, by former commissioner, and the two past directors of corrections. Charles Campbell was involved early on, and
clearly supported several of the areas that, that were resolved in the fashion that they were. And Bob Hatrack, who was the most recent former director, also supported the direction that went. In fact, the Department of Law has always been in the position of simply setting up the alternatives, making recommendations, but the decision as to where to go has always rested with the defendants in this case, which have been primarily the Commissioner of Health and Social Services, Director of Corrections, and some of the administrators in the correctional system. If I can speak briefly about the different settlement agreements now, and I would do that. First of all, I'll speak to the one that was just settled, this order implemented last Friday, which deals with our prisoners in the federal system. That was an agreement that was entered into by the state last September. It was in the form at that time of a proposed settlement agreement as to that facet of the lawsuit. Anytime you have a class action in which there is a proposed settlement, it must be circulated to the members of the class so that the court has an opportunity to have comments from the members of the class and will then decide whether or not to order its implementation. That was done in this case. Copies were sent out to all Alaska prisoners in the federal system. Our prisoners, for your information, are in approximately 21 different institutions around the country. We are at, my understanding, we are at 200 now. Burlingham, the officials of the Federal Bureau in Burlingham, California, I think oftentimes don't have the latest information. I believe, according to Mr. Brown, who's here, that we are now maxed out at the 200 limit that the Federal Bureau has set for us. At any rate, we sent copies of the proposed settlement out to them on two different occasions, the second time because of some problems and some of them receiving it because of some modifications. And because of, a few critical issues, which I'll address very briefly in just a moment.
The matter was settled and the court did order its implementation. And I think, listen to the tape of the hearing last Friday, you'll see that while the state was not eager to settle that part of the lawsuit, and in fact, clearly under Mr. Endell, some different direction as to facets of it may have been taken, there clearly was what I believe to be a binding commitment by the prior administration, and as we indicated to the court, we did not oppose given that commitment, and some of the issues were, I believe the state's liability was extreme. We didn't oppose the court ordering its implementation at that time. The principal issues involved, which resulted in the settlement as to the federal part of the lawsuit, are two. One, we are limited, in fact, to 200 prisoners right now, and all indications are that federal officials want us as soon as possible to begin taking back our prisoners. The federal system right now houses over 26,000 prisoners nationwide. They have an extreme overcrowding problem, too. Some of their institutions are only at capacity. Others are in excess of capacity. And in a communication from Executive Director Norman Carlson, which I have a copy of that letter, I believe you've all been supplied with it, you'll see that as recent as last June, and it was made clear unofficially much before that, but officially last June, that the limit was at 200, and they expect us to begin taking prisoners back as soon as we attain sufficient bed space in state. Given that, and one of the primary legal issues raised in the case was, as I referred to earlier, requirement that the state must tape record disciplinary hearings of its prisoners. These are prisoners who are charged with rule infractions in the prisons and face such sanctions as solitary confinement or segregation, as we refer to it, the loss of good time that they've earned in the past. They could forfeit under prior rules as all the up to unlimited amounts of good time they've earned, which could result actually in years being added on to their sentence. Given those possible repercussions for rule violations, the Supreme Court decided in 1975 that in order to protect the prisoner's rights to due process, that there must be some adequate record that could be reviewed on appeal should the inmate choose to appeal what was done in a disciplinary hearing. The process of taking some notes or jotting down what occurred was deemed insufficient constitutionally by the Alaska Supreme Court. We have been doing that since sometime shortly after that decision came down in state. That does not present a problem for us in state. However, the Federal Bureau of Prisons does not do that. No court has required it as a matter of interpreting the federal constitution. Has required that in the federal system. given there are 26,000 prisoners and our numerous requests, if they do it, we would supply the tape recorders, the tapes, you know, any inconvenience would be caused, we would try to rectify. The federal system said, the federal officials, as much as they like to help us out, they can't be bothered by what they consider to be a fly in the ointment, 200 prisoners in their system of 26,000, and that if they did that for us, they'd start having similar or different kinds of requests from the various state systems, and there are several states who house prisoners in the federal system right now, although I do believe Alaska probably has more than any other state. Shortly after the New Mexico riot, New Mexico had more, and after the riots in Idaho a year or two ago, Idaho had more prisoners, but I think right now we probably have the most. At any rate, federal officials refused to do that for us. Given that, and the Department of Law's perception that even though that was perhaps a minor issue in the scheme of things, that was sufficient for the courts of Alaska to order that we provide that right for Alaska prisoners, and if we can't get that right provided to them in the federal system, we'd have to put the prisoners somewhere else where they could get that. And frankly, given the overcrowding that's endemic in most states across the country, familiarize yourself with that part of the settlement. We have agreed contingent on funding for a maximum security facility to return those Alaska prisoners who wished to be incarcerated in the state by the end of 1987. It gives us 5 years to get a handle on our overcrowding problem in state and to construct a facility. I have it on reliable information that at least a third of our prisoners out there prefer to remain out there. They've either were never Alaska residents, were just passing through the state when they committed their crimes. Their families have moved down there. They enjoy the greater variety of vocational rehabilitation programs that are admittedly available in the federal institutions, whatever, one reason or other, or they simply don't want to spend the time locked up, which our prisoners do, relative to the amount of freedom they have in the federal institutions. But we're looking at least a third who don't want to come back. So in terms of getting a handle on the numbers, so at least a third of the 200. In addition, there are limited areas where we can continue to incarcerate prisoners out there after 1987, where areas such as our inmates' lives may be in danger in state. If we can't find a sufficient secure institution for them, we can send them out. Those who have medical or psychiatric needs, which we can't sufficiently address. In addition, we've addressed certain inequities in terms of rights enjoyed by in-state prisoners, in terms of access to the parole board. We provided greater access to that by agreeing to request funding from the legislature for sufficient funds for at least a quorum of the parole board, that would be 3 out of 5 members, to travel out to the federal institutions when our prisoners become eligible for parole release hearings. The present practice is that one member on the board goes and one member on the staff of the parole board will go. That those individuals will meet with the prisoner, we'll have an interview with them and tape record the contents of the interview and bring it back, play it before the entire board, and the board will then make its decision on the basis of that. Well, in state, all prisoners who are eligible for parole appear before either the entire board or at least a quorum. And both, in speaking with Mr. Sam Trivett, the executive director of the board, I think he was candid enough to agree, and I think logic dictates that at least in a close case, a personal appearance, the credibility of the individual may make some difference, one way or the other, whether or not to release the individual. At any rate, we simply agree to try to make more equal what our prisoners out in the federal system get compared to what they do in state. In addition, there are some things with lesser financial implications, such as providing a limited amount of Alaskan law materials in the law libraries in the federal system, allowing inmates to compensating their attorneys up to $15 a month for collect calls from our prisoners out there when they're involved in litigation. There's been a record of problems in terms of Alaska prisoners contacting their attorneys, communicating with them. This all falls under the heading of access to the courts, which is something that the U.S. Supreme Court and courts around the country have dealt with since 1976, I believe, the Valens v. Smith case. And we've also agreed to request funding for one full-time position to would be primarily responsible for dealing with our prisoners, responding to their inquiries, advising them as to what they need to put into parole application plans. This is not an advocate in terms of arguing for their release or against it in terms of parole release hearings, but simply to give them all available information when they're applying for whatever available programs are there. Mr. Brown is presently acting in that capacity now, although he's wearing two hats because he's also assisting on in-state classification matters. And largely because of the overcrowding, we do need what we're looking at, the way corrections officials have described us in the past, we have what amounts to an Alaska institution of 200 prisoners down in the lower 48. It may cover 21 different institutions, but in essence, there are 200 prisoners there. Certainly warrants at least one full-time person to deal with the problems created by those individuals or that they encounter in the federal system. In-state, as you're aware, and incidentally, I have copies of both the in-state partial settlement and the FEP settlement. If any of you would like copies, I have sufficient numbers for all of you. In-state, this is a much more lengthy document, as I'm sure you're aware, covers some 38 or 39 pages.
Let
me interrupt. As I understand, the FBP portion of the lawsuit also sets some standards for sending future people down. Is that correct?
Well, it does set some criteria which are basically already in existence. It's pretty much the same criteria they use now for sending prisoners out. What we did in addition, however, was to set some criteria for interim standards for return. Between now and 1987, how we would begin returning prisoners. Those prisoners who are within 2 years of their release date would have the right to be returned within 60 days of reaching that, falling in, eligible in that category. The main reason being, and it's clear the direction that even Mr. Adele wants to go now, which is, and it's in fact a direction that is done throughout the federal system and many state systems, it's in reintegrating prisoners back into the community, put them in a halfway house setting, or some type of intermediary supervision setting, so that when they're released from years of incarceration right out into the community, to avoid the shock that occurs and the much stronger likelihood of them violating the law and returning back to the correctional system. At any rate, that would be aimed at, again, those prisoners who want to come back to the state would come back when they have 2 years left to familiarize themselves with halfway house programs, counseling programs that are available, make application for jobs, those kinds of things. Also, those prisoners whose lives are endangered in the federal system, and we have verified that, would have the right to come back. There are a few other categories which do not automatically require coming back, but which indicate some priority should be given to them. They deal with prisoners who are young, who have never been incarcerated before, members of the native population of the state who have never lived in urban areas before, and who have been out there for only a short time, because once they've been out there for in excess of 2 years, at least plaintiff's counsel felt that the shock, the culture shock that was going to occur, had already taken place. That was their judgment. At any rate, what we are now, given the fact that we have 200 out there, we are on a one-for-one basis anyway. So anytime we want to send another prisoner out there, we've got to bring one back, and we've set some guidelines in determining how we'll be doing that. The in-state portion of the settlement agreement, as Mr. Gorsuch indicated, settled those items which primarily could be resolved within existing budgetary resources. There were a few exceptions. The principal amount of the money that's been requested or will shortly be requested in the form of a supplemental to fund that, and that the $300,000 figure was put out to you, is primarily for compliance monitors for each of the institutions, and a position which would be a central office compliance monitor, somebody who would oversee the compliance monitors in the in-state institutions. The reason that was done was because plaintiffs strongly argued for a special master to be appointed by the court to oversee the implementation of this agreement. And we resisted that with as much strength as we could. We felt that the problems that most other states that have had special masters have experienced would be experienced here, in that we have somebody who worked for the court system running our Division of Corrections, telling us where to spend the money, how much to spend, how to do certain things. And we resisted that extremely vocally and asked the court to allow defendants themselves to oversee the implementation of the settlement agreement. And we argued that the state had exhibited numerous amounts of good faith in the negotiation process and the positions that they had taken. And the court
based on that exhibition of good process, which the court, good faith, which the court felt had been demonstrated, they allowed the state to oversee the implementation of the agreement and compliance with it. And either way, we'd be footing the bill. If a special master was appointed, the state would have to pay for that and whatever employees the special master required. But this way, we have people within the Division of Corrections who work in the institutions overseeing compliance with the requirements of the court order.
If I may interrupt you, Representative Barn, to have a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do. I want to stop him on the question of funding for the special master or for the special whatever he is. I would like to ask you, since you obviously don't have the power of appropriation, and only the legislature does, what happens if we decide not to fund your settlement?
Well, what I think would happen, since the funds primarily, again, are only for compliance monitoring,
if the institutions, and they don't appear able right now, to find sufficient staff time to oversee the implementation, it is a full-time job. And if that does not occur, then I think it's a strong likelihood that the court would end up appointing a special master and have the court system run corrections rather than the state itself.
In that regard, Mr. Chairman, if I may continue, then I'm presuming that the court system then also has the power to appropriate money to run the court system, or they've got sufficient funds to take it out of their budget and they won't need nearly as much next year. Is that correct?
I don't feel qualified to speak on the budgetary process regarding the court system.
I might remind you that in your testimony there you said that you know, you wanted to keep it this way so the state wouldn't have to pay for him. Pay for the court system's budget too, so the state pays for it either way.
Well, if I could just follow up, Mr. Chairman, and during your testimony, if you would think about that a bit, and since all these commitments have been made that only the legislature can appropriate money for, perhaps you can tell us what will happen if we don't give them that money and we don't give the court system any more money.
Go ahead and respond. You want to respond, Mr. Stark?
I understood Representative Barnes asked me to think about that.
Just want to refresh your memory about the testimony of the Attorney General. He described three possible scenarios, of course.
Representative Clarkson, it would be more than refreshing my testimony because I didn't hear him. I was late.
That's why I get to tell you now. He said the three possible alternatives were, of course, that the court could hold the administration officials in contempt, even though they tried with their best efforts to obtain the money, contempt of court. Secondly, they could take control of the prison system itself, and he certainly isn't advocating any of these things. Thirdly, he at least floated the possibility that the court system would, in fact, appropriate the money for the legislature, would seize money from the general fund.
That he hastened to add that if we found him in contempt, it would be very uncomfortable.
Perhaps I could enlarge upon that a little bit also. There have been one or two federal courts that I'm aware of, and there may well be more. I haven't done an exhaustive amount of research in the area, which have basically appropriated money, have told the state that they must spend money in a certain way related to prison litigation. There's no question at all that should the scenario that you described occur, that it would precipitate a constitutional crisis. There's no telling what would happen.
I suspect.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then I would suspect that through all of our appeal process, that those of us that are elected to control the purse strings, that we could be in court for many, many years by the time they got around to collecting the money from us, right?
Certainly the appeal process is time-consuming. But the courts, I think, have the power to order interim measures. And in fact, unless the appellate court was agreeable to staying any order by a lower court, I think we would then be faced right away with that constitutional crisis and the threat of contempt and sanctions, fines, actually imprisonment, all possible.
Representative Malone?
I think probably, though, certainly most of the people that serve in the legislature, I'm sure all the people on this committee want to avoid any constitutional crisis to resolve the problems of our system. So I don't think I envision this constitutional crisis actually occurring.
We simply a question, Mr. Chairman.
Sandy Barnes.
Simply a question, Mr. Chairman, and it's certainly, you know, any time somebody goes down to the courthouse and negotiates a settlement for the legislature that they didn't bother to inform the legislature about over the period of time that they were doing the negotiating, it gives me a great deal of heartburn. Thank you.
Well, in fact, and I will get there shortly, that is why the Department of Law and the defendants in this lawsuit did not commit on any of the large ticket items as referred to by Attorney General Gorsuch to allow both the new administration and the legislature an opportunity to review those independently.
I had written down a question during your testimony there. Did it ever occur to you or anybody in the Attorney General's office to approach the legislature in 1981 and 82 when you realized there were problems of this magnitude and informed the legislature?
What I did was informed, while I was in close contact with the Director of Corrections, the Commissioner of Health and Social Services, and the Attorney General. I met with Mr. Reinwein in the Governor's office, informed him. I assumed if the legislature was going to be contacted, and I think it definitely was a good idea, that it would be done through the auspices of the Governor's office. I didn't feel it was my responsibility personally to be doing that. I was simply counsel representing the defendants. No question that the legislature should have been contacted. And, of course, as you're aware, many members of the legislature now are people who were not in the legislature last year. But certainly several people obviously are
yeah, I realize that, but no one was informed, even the legislature at that time. And it obviously was a problem of sufficient magnitude that someone in your department, and certainly the governor's department, should have been doing that.
I'm not in a position to speak for the prior governor's office, other than the fact that they were aware of what was going on.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Clarkson.
Let me just correct that statement of yours, that the legislature has been fully informed since at least 1977 of the pending problems with the overcrowding of the prisons and possible repercussions from that. And I'm sure if you went and asked the administration, they could easily document, and I've seen that material. We've known that this is coming. We've known that it's coming, been coming for years, and no one can seriously suggest that this is a big surprise that happened in late 1981.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, let me see now. I've been here since 1979. I served on the Hess Committee for 2 years, the Judiciary Committee for 2 years, the committees that the problem would have been appropriately brought to. Not during that period of time was the Clary case or any problems with the overcrowding, although obviously some of us from reading the newspapers are not oblivious to the fact that those problems are taking place. In fact, I've been here since then, and this is the first time, and at the request of the committee chair, that the members of the administration who are negotiating these problems, going through the processes, has ever come before a committee unless they were specifically invited by the committee to do so.
I would like to say one thing, if I may. Last November, former Director of Corrections, Bob Hatrack, wanted to in conjunction, I believe, with the Anchorage Crime Commission, conduct some kind of a session which would inform newly elected members of the legislature as to what was going on. And I think because of the change in administration and the uncertainties involved, that never occurred. There was a desire for that to happen at that time.
Representative Barnes.
Mr. Chairman, might I state to you, Mr. Stark, that then Mr. Hatright misinformed you, because at my own request, I held a hearing last November. And at that time, Mr. Hatrack was presented with numerous questions that he should come back with an answer to the committee with, and to this date, I'm still waiting for those answers to be presented. So, not at Mr. Hatrack's request, but at my very own, we held a hearing and discussed not only this particular case, but the problems in correction, and I'm still waiting again for the answers.
Well, perhaps in discussing the settlement now, I might actually provide some of those answers.
Yes, if you'd quickly proceed, we'd appreciate that.
Before I actually get into, well, actually I will cover some of the areas that are addressed in the settlement agreement, but I thought you might have a better appreciation for what went on in the negotiation process if I indicate just a few examples of some of the things the prisoners actually asked for and what defendants were willing to agree to in these areas. Regarding the problem of overcrowding, which I don't think anyone questions exists and is a serious problem, and in fact results in most of the other problems our correctional system has, the plaintiffs asked for immediate reduction in all our prison facilities to design capacity, which we exceed in nearly every facility right now, and to 80 square feet of floor space per prisoner. What we did agree to and what we got the court to agree to was to allow the state, or defendants in this case, to come up with their own population management plan, which would be, again, what correctional officials in this state, how they plan to deal with the problem in their own way. We gained several months leeway to address this problem. And in fact, if the plan that is now in the process of being developed, and which needs to be presented to the court in the next couple of weeks, if, in fact, does not achieve a management of the overcrowding problem, we're likely to see the court stepping in and doing something. What we did was we bought some time and allowed the state to come up with its own plan rather than the court dictating how it would be done. What we're doing is leaving the problem to the professionals, our people in corrections in the state. And that's how we responded to their request there. They had asked for separation of all felons, all misdemeanants, and all pretrial detainees in our prison system. We did agree to separation in housing areas only for pretrial detainees and sentenced felons. Several real quick, small but significant items in terms of management of facilities regarding, we went to requests for attorneys to participate in disciplinary hearings. We refused to agree to that, only to staff advocates representing the inmates in those hearings, which is basically what although some courts have talked about attorneys, I think clearly it's supportable in the position we've taken. They requested such things relating to, physical plan, temperature. They wanted the temperature in the institutions to be between 68 and 75 degrees. We took a look at standards, and the position we took was we would agree to keep the temperatures in the institutions between 65 and 80 rather than 68 and 75. They wanted hours for attorneys to be able to come to the institutions to be 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. We ended up agreeing to 8 to 10. They wanted all inmates to be able to wear their own clothing in the institutions. We ended up agreeing only to pretrial detainees and in their housing areas only. That would either be the cell or the dorm, nowhere else in the institution. They wanted free access to all kinds of books from friends. We ended up agreeing only to paperback books because of the risks of contraband being hidden in hardback books. They wanted open visiting every day for prisoners, basically 8 or 10 hours a day in all institutions. This is one of the items that's still reserved for litigation, but the most we agreed to and what we got plaintiffs to accept as part of a proposed resolution of this issue was a maximum of 30 hours per week for our large institutions and 24 hours per week for our small institutions. And that means that the institution itself would have that number of visiting hours, not that the individual prisoners would be able to visit for that period of time. But again, that is, since that is a large money item because of the need for extra staff to deal with that problem, that's not resolved. There are, I think, many concerns that I've discovered exist as a result of portions of the settlement agreement that are based at least partially on misinformation. One problem that we've got with a settlement agreement is you have two sides drafting the language for it. There are many portions, in fact, if you look at the in-state settlement agreement, you can see it's on plaintiff's counsel stationery. And in fact, the language of many of the provisions comes from plaintiffs. Even where I felt the language was vague and poorly drafted, and there's no question that many of these provisions are, and I think had the state been the one to draft the entire agreement, it would have been more clear as to what was intended. But even where the language was poor and it was vague, and might be confused as to what was intended, as long as I understood and I felt that the correctional officials understood what was intended, that was the important thing. A few provisions, let me address just a handful that I understand may have some concern for members of the committee and which I think are basically an example of misinformation or concern that need not be there. One, I met with Chairman Bussell just the other morning, expressed a concern about a provision regarding defendants agreeing to provide law librarians for the inmates. What in fact that provision does is provide that the superintendent of the facility will select on his own a particular inmate who will work in the law library at whatever the gratuity is for inmates who are working, which is, you know, maximum $3 a day right now, and that he would be there to assist inmates in the use of the law library materials. That is all. I've heard that there are concerns that the state has to go out and hire individuals to come and work as law librarians in the institutions, and that is simply not the case.
If I could stop you right there, what forced me to ask that question and what forced me to doubt what you're saying is that when I turned to Third Avenue or the intake facility at Post Road, I was told by the officials that are going to manage that that law books were far too expensive to allow inmates to handle them. Therefore, they had to bring a librarian on staff to handle and to take care of this. And they have, in fact, created a room in the law library to house this outside person who will then control the library. So what you're saying doesn't make sense in the light of not only what I saw, but what the actual people who are going to manage the facility intend to do.
Well, you know, perhaps Mr. Endell or somebody within the Division of Corrections can tell you what their plans are for those institutions. I can only speak as to what this provision requires of the state. Whether, in fact, and there's certainly no question that things in addition to this are good management practices, but I'm not speaking to those, and Mr. Endell certainly in a better position to do that.
Let me ask you another question. Well, you brought the law library business up, and are you telling me, or you obviously know a lot about law books, can law books be maintained and used by people that are in a prison properly?
I'd have to give you a yes and no answer. The reason being is because there are numerous incidents in the institutions when the supervision is not as good as it could be, where inmates have destroyed materials. They've ripped pages out, or something they like in a law book, they'll tear it out, they've got it, and it's not available to anybody. But in fact, that happens in our law libraries, not in the prison institution. not quite as much, I think. But at any rate, if a sufficiently trustworthy inmate were to be designated a law librarian, that would certainly be one of his responsibilities to make sure that the books were not destroyed, the materials.
That would comply, in your opinion.
Sure.
Okay.
But I think, you know, you have to look at the types of institutions and the types of inmates that are being held. Some institutions, the superintendents may justifiably feel that there aren't those kinds of inmates which either I have the desire to be a law librarian and at the same time are trustworthy enough to prevent that kind of destruction. I can't speak to that. The superintendents can.
Representative Clarkson.
Well, let me just ask a question here about implementation. We're obviously not going to finish by then, but on that, the implementation date is January 8, 1983.
Right, that's
what we're doing on that.
Okay, what? This was a settlement agreement that was scheduled to go into effect on December 9th, and the time frames that are listed were based on that date. What we did as a result of a request, the 2 hours before the hearing on December 9th, the request of Governor Sheffield was asked the court for additional time for the administration to be able to review the contents of it. To decide if in fact there were any portions that they were going to ask to be modified, or actually to have time to not only become familiar with it, but to analyze whether it's something that the state felt it could or should try to back out from. And what we did was we gained 30 days at that time, and then just before the next hearing, 30 days later, we gained an additional 2 weeks. So it wasn't until January 21st that the hearing was ordered. Those deadlines that had already been passed at that time, I think it was anticipated that those would be complied with as quickly as possible, and those days in the future would act as firm deadlines. One other area that I know has been some concern deals with the provision of certain exercise equipment to prisoners in punitive segregation. These are prisoners who have been separated from the general population for rule infractions. And what it provides for is that inmates who are in punitive segregation for longer than 3 days would have access to large muscle group exercise equipment in an area sufficiently large enough to accommodate it. What the courts have done is when anybody is in a segregation status for more than a few days, they have required, as a constitutional basis, that inmates have access to exercise, physical deterioration. We looked at some of the recent decisions of the courts, the Texas decision this past summer as a good example. I spoke with medical directors of correctional systems in three different states as to what's been going on there, what kind of what do they do for prisoners in that kind of a segregation status? Almost uniformly, what the least expensive way to handle that is to have a separate exercise yard for prisoners in segregation right off the segregation units. Unfortunately, we only have one or two facilities that have that. All of the federal institutions have that. So what you can do is allow an area for the inmates to exercise in where they're not mixing with the general population. And it doesn't require the levels of supervision because you've got it in a closed area. What we have here is a gymnasium in some institutions and an outside yard in some institutions. And if we were not going to provide some alternative for our inmates in segregation, we'd be forced to bring our maximum security, our segregation prisoners, out into exercise areas that are being used by the general population. And the amount of staff, extra staff that would be required to supervise this, to actually, some of those prisoners have to be separated from each other for obvious reasons in terms of threats of violence or escape and so on. In order to avoid that, we tried to look for an inexpensive compromise, and that resulted in us talking with these directors, medical directors, in terms of what the, since it is really a medical question, the exercise question, what kinds of equipment and how inexpensive it could be. And if we provided that equipment for the inmates, then we would not have to come up with the extra staff to take them to the gymnasium, to take them outside. So we're looking at providing them relatively inexpensive equipment, 1 hour a day only, outside their cell. We differentiated between the right to recreation and the right to exercise. We're speaking only about exercise right now, not recreative status. We'll not be receiving access to games and whatever things that might be available to the general population. And so what we've done is, I think, resulted in a substantial cost savings to the state in that area, and encouraging the correctional system to the extent it can to go forward with the idea of building a small enclosed outside recreation area attached to these segregation units. I know that's the direction we're going in the Fairbanks renovations that are occurring right now. We already have such an area in the Palmer Medium facility that the members of the legislature funded last year on 81.
Representative Liska.
Mr. Stark, how long have you been with the prison system now, Mr. Attorney?
I've been counsel to the Division of Corrections for almost 3 years. Prior to that, I was a prosecutor for the state for 5 years.
Okay, we're talking about muscle rooms for exercise. Do you consider pool tables in that category?
No, that is clearly a recreation item, which as a management tool, I think corrections use to help relieve some of the tensions of the overcrowding and so on. But that's certainly not a requirement by statute or constitution.
Do you know offhand how many pool tables we have in the system now?
No, sir, I do not. Mr. Endell, or perhaps Mr. Houston, who's superintendent of the juvenile facility, might be able to answer that.
Thank you.
I'd like to just make a comment about that exercise. I was reading in the this implement, what do they call this? They call this the Clary's Partial Settlement Compliance Manual on page 10 that you were going to furnish a bicycle, a trampoline, and a tumbling mat in an area sufficiently large enough to accommodate all three simultaneously.
Those are...
When you were negotiating these things, did you think to, or did it occur to you to suggest to the court that there are millions of people who have been trained for combat in this country that have been doing push-ups and running in place, and you know, you're talking about muscle building and mind training. The military has been training people for years and years, and I don't ever remember in all of my time in the service ever seeing a trampoline that we jumped on, and I never rode a bicycle unless it was to get somewhere, and I certainly never had that much room to do it in most of the time.
The kinds of equipment that we're talking about, first of all, are a small one-person jogging trampoline. You may be familiar with that. Somebody just runs in place on the trampoline. The bicycle is actually a bicycle exercise machine which somebody would exercise his legs in place. And a tumbling mat speaks for itself. It's a mat where they can do the kind of calisthenics that you actually just described. And we didn't pull those out of the sky. What we did was look at what, in fact, the exact position which you're suggesting, which is calisthenics, is something that has been suggested by correctional systems down through the years in all of these lawsuits, and the courts simply do not buy it as being sufficient, because what happens is they end up inmates being placed in a very small catwalk area just outside their cell and told, if you want to exercise, you can do push-ups or whatever. What we in fact have done though is we got the plaintiffs to agree that for the first 3 days that our inmates are in segregation, that's in fact all they're going to get, is just the access to that small catwalk area to walk or to jumping jack or do push-ups or whatever. But it's quite clear from the court decisions and from talking with the directors of these other systems which have been in litigation that the courts require the kinds of exercise equipment that we agreed to. And it, again, it is, I think, limited. It's not, I mean, when you picture a trampoline, and I, frankly, as a taxpayer, I'm not very happy about that either, but we're not talking about a one-person thing.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you recite to me what court decisions have required trampolines, bicycles, those sorts of items to be furnished to the prisoners?
I'm not aware of any that have required specifically that equipment. I have talked to, in talking to the different individuals in these, well, the medical director of the Oklahoma system, the Illinois system, and the New York system, I asked them, the courts speak in terms of large muscle group activity or large muscle group exercise. I asked these individuals to suggest to us the kinds of equipment that would provide that kind of exercise that's required by the courts. And that's where we came up with that kind of equipment. We were looking for equipment that was relatively inexpensive. Obviously, we talk about universal gyms, for instance, which will cost $8,000 to $10,000 sometimes. We didn't want to go to that kind of equipment because it's just too expensive. We're talking about equipment that can be purchased for a few hundred dollars for each institution. And so we had the same concerns that you had in mind, which is frankly the available resources.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You talk about large muscle toning. Did you ever participate in football or basketball?
Certainly.
Did they have those kinds of machines? I remember them doing push-ups and this sort of thing and running in place and running around.
What we've done here is rather than have to bring our inmates outside of the institution to an exercise yard or to the gymnasium, this is the alternative to reduce the amount of staff time involved, to reduce the risk of escape or violence by those inmates. We have agreed to put this equipment in a secure area of the institution. This is something that the correctional administrators wanted. They did not want to have to bring the prisoners out to the gymnasium or to the exercise yard because of the risk these inmates are threatened in the institution.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know what you're getting to ask and ready to ask, so I can just read your thought ways here, and I'm going to let you take care of that. I want to ask you one other thing before we run out of time. In your earlier testimony, you said you brought three people up here to review the lawsuit. I would like to know, were those the three hat track men that you brought up here and gave the contract to do the plan, the management plan?
Now, the individuals were Tony Trevisano, who was the executive director of the American Correctional Association, Sanger Powers, who was director for the Wisconsin prison system for 20 years, and an individual who, I'm sorry, his name escapes me at the moment, but he is in Florida and has testified in 30-some-odd prison lawsuits around the country. Now, those were the individuals.
I'd like to leave that for a moment, but I do at some point would like to come back to that management plan and those particular people's involvement in it.
Certainly, to the extent I can answer any questions on that.
Thank you.
Perhaps I ought to
sum up.
I will sum up. If I could just talk briefly about the issues that are reserved.
You know, I got to apologize to everybody. When we first started looking at using today's work schedule to talk about Clary, I just like everybody else didn't understand the immensity of the thing, and when we made the agenda up, it just began to grow and grow and grow, and obviously it's a lot larger problem than we had originally thought, and it's going to require more and more time, and I'd like to apologize to those who have not yet testified. Aside from what it said in the June paper, most legislators do have a rather heavy schedule, and it's going to be difficult for us to continue much longer. I'd like to continue until we got most of your testimony in today. If the rest of the committee members wouldn't object, and for those who haven't yet gotten to testify today, you'll have to accept my apology, and we'll have to reschedule for another day because most of the stuff we do need. Representative Clarkson.
Representative Bessel, I will be leaving the second that Representative Locker leaves. Her committee meeting is the next meeting, which starts in 8 minutes or so. So even if I have to leave in the middle of the testimony, I think it's important to keep the committee schedule going in the afternoon and not mess that up. So I may have to leave.
If you don't have too much more, we'd like to have you continue. If you have spots more,
I did want to let you know what issues have not yet been resolved in the case. These are basically the large ticket items as referred to by Attorney General Gorsuch, and make just a few comments about those, if I could. Those issues are, and again, some are less significant than others, sufficient clothing in the institutions for exercise and recreation. Recreation itself, state law requires that we provide inmates 7 hours per week. The known facility right now, the inmates are lucky to get an hour or two a week. There is insufficient staff to escort the prisoners down the block to the National Guard Army, which is available if we had enough staff to take the prisoners down. Visitation, the number of hours, we spoke about that briefly in terms of what was originally requested by the prisoners and the proposed final agreement on these issues. And again, we did reach a proposed resolution on all of these issues. Because of the large amount of money involved, again, have not signed off or committed ourselves to it. And I believe that Mr. Andell has a plan in mind, which he'll address to you at the appropriate time, which will, he believes, and I'm hopeful, will address these issues in a manner which should be considered less expensive to the state. At any rate, visitation and the staff that's involved in increasing visitation. Right now, for your information, most institutions around the state provide no more than 6 hours a week in which visitation occurs in the facility, and these are facilities that have, some of them have more than 200 prisoners. The area of safety is still reserved, which regards pre-hire psychological screening for staff members who are being hired who have regular contact with prisoners. Mr. Chairman.
I'm somewhat perplexed with that remark. If all these facilities that have over 200 prisons, the Division of Adult Corrections handed me or got for the committee a count of people, and I don't show a single facility in the state of Alaska with over 200 counts, so I don't know where all these facilities are.
The Fairbanks facility, the Fairbanks facility frequently has over 200. That's a facility that's designed for 110. Highland Mountain facility, which is the one located in Eagle River, I don't know what today's count is, but certainly for the last several months has been in excess of 200. The two Palmer facilities, which are side by side combined, have well in excess of 200. Those are the ones I was referring to on that figure.
Okay.
The safety area, which is a screening of new staff that's being hired, the question of crisis intervention counseling, and which affects the training program and the staff that's needed to enlarge upon training. The question of the contents of the training program. Right now, the training program for correctional officers is 3 weeks in length. In years past, it has been 6 weeks, and it's been whittled down just because of the lack of resources. There are many areas which simply are never covered in the training of correctional officers, and there's a great need for follow-up in refresher training in years after they first become employed as correctional officers. Training needs to take place in the area of transportation of prisoners. As you're probably aware, the state troopers do most prisoner transporting. But we have a serious problem in that medical appointments for prisoners are oftentimes canceled at the last minute because troopers have other things to do. If, in fact, corrections it was handling transportation of prisoners, then corrections' own priorities would certainly dictate that those kinds of appointments would be kept. Question of overcrowding. I've made reference to it. We have to get a handle on the overcrowding. We have bought some time from the court to do that. Question of rehabilitation and treatment. Question of programs in the facilities. The question of jobs for prisoners, both to do away with the idleness which is there and to perhaps recoup some of the costs that the prisoners have placed upon the state because of having to incarcerate them. Question of counseling, of different kinds of programs dealing with management of stress for prisoners. Lots of crimes are committed because people cannot handle the anger that they're feeling, and so they strike out, either hurting people, damaging property, whatever. Question of release support or developing some programs for our prisoners who are on probation or parole in the first short weeks after their release from the prison to help them in their integration back into society and hopefully avoid them coming back into the system. question of increased staffing across the board to try to do the kinds of things that are required by state law and that the correctional system wants to do. We've had numerous staffing studies done over the last several years, and every one of them indicates that our facilities are simply understaffed. And I'm sure you can appreciate that that's aggravated much more now because of the overcrowding that's occurring. There simply aren't enough staff members to do the kinds of things that the system is designed to do because of the overcrowding. The area of healthcare is an extreme problem in that we have some institutions now where we don't have medical staff on duty for several hours a day, particularly in nighttime hours. Fairbanks, I mentioned, where oftentimes the population count is 190, 200. There is nobody that is a medically trained person who's on duty in the night hours there. Obviously, in an emergency, forced to drive a prisoner to the hospital. Some emergencies, that kind of time makes all the difference if you've got a trained medical person on staff.
Can I stop you here for a minute? You guys are considering all this requirement to have all these people, and all these guys are locked in their cells at night. Do you know how many people the Anchorage Westward Hotel holds, or the Captain Cook, or any major hotel in the state? Would you think there'd be more than 200 people in bed there at night on any given night?
I'm sure
that any of those hotels maintain a medical staff downstairs waiting for someone to get sick.
There's certainly one quantitative difference, or qualitative difference, and that's the fact that those people at the Westward Hotel, if they get sick, they can leave, go to a doctor. Prisoners can't leave. The courts have found clearly a responsibility when we incarcerate prisoners, we've got to provide medical care for them.
All you said was that in case one of these guys got sick, we had to transport them, and they get transported the same night as...
Let me give you an example of what happened at the Fairbanks Institution. I just spoke with Superintendent Calderon 2 days ago. They've had two prisoners who have died. One